This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton, and I'm in for show number 83. Some of you may have noticed there was no show last week. Well, I went away. That's because, of course, last week was Thanksgiving, and this is a one-man operation here, and I figured I deserved a few days off, so I went down to California to spend Thanksgiving with my family. Our family get-togethers are usually pretty pleasant things. Unlike some families, there's not a whole lot of drama. We're all getting kind of long in the tooth, and we're learning to appreciate each other in ways that perhaps we didn't when we were younger, and come to celebrate our differences. But you're not here to hear about my family. And fair warning, there's a good chance that I'll take a couple of weeks off for the Christmas and New Year's holidays. On the other hand, maybe I'll get busy and do a special show for Christmas. Bloody, bloody Christmas. That might be fun. Anyway, speaking of fun, do I say anyway too much? I'll bet I do. But speaking of fun, I want to talk for a moment about the series that's coming up here at the top of the show. I'll bet most of you can tell that I don't rehearse and that I don't even write anything out. Oh, I got notes. Of course I got notes, and I work from the notes. Sometimes the notes are even right. Anyway, back to crime classics. Crime classics is sometimes called a docudrama. You know, I've been guilty of that myself. But I've come to think that this is maybe just a little bit too grand a claim. To start out with, you have in the person of the host a completely fictional expert named Thomas Highland. There never was a Thomas Highland. And then digging around in the backgrounds for some of the individual programs, I find the historical content to be a bit dodgy. And the show willingly repeats some legends and interesting anecdotes as though they were well-established facts. You know, though, nevertheless, I'm going to say right here and now that I like this program. And, you know, this was just entertainment. Certainly, it's respect for historicity. Oh, boy, boys and girls, I'm not sure I said historicity right. In fact, you know, there may not even be such a word. But that's okay. You'll forgive me, won't you? What was I going to say? Something about historicity. Oh, yeah, I was going to say that crime classics' disregard of historical accuracy is no worse and probably less unrestrained than many of our recent historical pageants. Tonight's show, for example, is actually, from what I've been able to see, pretty accurate. It's the story of a popular farmhand and a farmer's daughter. That's not an altogether pleasant story. Of course, you really couldn't expect it to be an altogether pleasant story. It is crime classics, after all. It concerns the fate of a young woman named Mariah Martin at the hands of a young man named William Corder in the spring of 1827. It's also an extremely entertaining look inside the head of a complete sociopath. A dip into history in the company of an engaging, quite likable, and totally cold-blooded killer. This crime classics is a retelling, and as I said, a reasonably accurate retelling, of the events surrounding what has become known as the Red Barn Murder. It originally aired on November the 25th of 1953. Anyway, I'm going to turn you over to the tender mercies of Mr. Thomas Hyland. Well, actually, it's Lou Merrill, who was a popular radio actor throughout the 30s and 40s, and successful on television in the 1950s. Lou Merrill died in 1963, so if you've never heard of him and you yourself are under 50 or so, well, that's understandable.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Hyland with another true story of crime. Listen. That's a cricket, a Suffolk County cricket, and he's chirping away at a merry pace. Therefore, he's a male cricket, for among crickets, only this sex can chirp. At the present moment, this particular fellow happens to be in a hayloft in an English barn. The year is 1827, and it's spring, and it's evening, and it's warm. And if you're going to be a cricket, now is the time, for the hay lies sleek against your antenna. Oh, my, yes. Dead cricket. 120 pounds of country girl just fell on him. Girl's name, Mariah Martin, and she was a dead weight. So tonight, my report to you on the killing story of William Corder and the farmer's daughter.
Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Hyland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Mr. Thomas Hyland.
England in 1827 was between periods. A decade before, Napoleon had met his Waterloo, and a decade later, Victoria was to sit on the throne. True, in this year, which concerns us, the country was briefly stunned by the affair Lavarie, which almost cost England the continent of Australia, until cooler heads and more honest bookkeeping prevailed. And when the shuddering was done and normalcy returned, people returned to normal pursuits, which included the young folk. For instance, Mariah Martin. A giggler, 5'2", 120 pounds. Pretty. Demure. And the most chuckable chin in Polstead. Which chin-chucking was being done by William Corder?
Mariah. Pinklin. Pinklin Mariah.
Oh, you're the one, William, you are.
Twice over, Pinklin.
Oh, God.
Yes, you be. And sweet smelling you are, too.
Oh, did the hay you smell in the month of May?
In your dilly hair.
Gaw. Gaw. Oh, and just to think, William.
To think what?
All the seasons from now on, from May to December, and then start a new year, and all that near and the next.
What? What talk you?
For every month, for every season, you are mine.
I have not said that, or perhaps sometimes...
What?
I want to go. I want to leave here. I want to...
Oh, your dilly mouth moves so sweetly and says nothing at all. You'll not go from me, William.
Oh?
Because you will marry me. You must marry me, William.
Must I?
Oh, yes, else...
Else what?
I will tell. I will tell what you did, William. I would.
Mariah...
How you stole from my poor daddy.
Mariah.
You cannot understand how his poor money was dug up and taken away.
Mariah, I want to say a word.
And should I say what happened, to the jail you would go, lad. Maybe hung. I heard in Ipswich they did a hanging recent to a lad which stole a heifer.
Mariah, will you listen to me?
And I do so love you. A thiefling, but I love you.
Mariah, will you marry me?
Oh, you've been trying to say it all the time.
Of course I have.
Of course you have.
Pinklin.
Oh, Gaw.
I would like to read to you a description of William Corder as taken from a 19th century journal. He was about 5 feet 6 inches in height, usually affected a drab greatcoat, plaid lilac handkerchief, a black dress coat and blue pantaloons, and had rather a large nose, a small face, and a ring on the little finger of his right hand. That was William Corder. Of course, since this was spring and a warm one, he took off his drab greatcoat, especially on the evening when he left Moriah and went home and sharpened a knife. Oh, he was a handy man. That's why he was so useful around the various farms in Paulstead. Everybody loved him. Everybody needed him. To mend a plow or stretch a thong, the cry went up, "Aye, Billy Corder!" This with smiling affection. And the next morning, when he went to the farm of his betrothed,
"Aye, Billy Corder!"
From Mariah's father,
"Aye, Billy Corder!"
From her mother,
"A morning, William."
"A morning to each of you."
"You look weary, Billy. Come into the house and I'll tea you nice and with some dilly biscuits."
"Now, Ma."
"He looks weary."
"Leave him be, Ma.
What you been doing, Billy?"
"A sharpening."
"Oh, what a sharpening?"
"Knives, for the farmers all about."
"I give you a hand whenever you'd want, Billy."
"Howdy, oh. But I come this morning with another favor to ask."
"Oh, my."
"What favor, Billy boy?"
"Concerning..."
Oh, my.
"Concerning what, Billy boy?"
"My love. My pinkling. My dilly girl, Mariah.
I be losing her, Billy boy."
"You be good to Billy, Mariah."
"Now, Ma."
"Just be good to him, you hear?"
"Yes, Ma."
"Then you be saying yes to what I'm asking?"
"I'm saying it."
"Then, here's a thing."
"A dowry thing, eh? Well, since there was the stealing, since my poor money was dug by robbers, there's not very much I have.
But, surely...
I am a farmer, but my ground is clay and rocks."
"And you are a mole catcher."
"And I cannot run fast no more."
"Come here to me, Billy."
"Here I be."
"But closer the mother to a son. Son. Son."
"Yes?"
"I have a farthing put aside for Mariah and for you."
"Oh, Taddeo. And there's a pistol I like so much in the parlor."
"For what a pistol?"
"Which I must have. Traveling as we are, Mariah and me, to London for the marriage."
"To London you go? To be wed?"
"Yes."
"Oh, lad, oh, village is every girl dreaming. London to be married in."
"You're my true love, Mariah. Tonight I'll fetch you and we'll go down to London. Or better..."
"Oh, what better could there be?"
"The Red Barn, you know it. I'll meet you there at the crossroads."
"Oh, whatever you say, love. Ain't he a love, Ma?"
"Oh, he's a love, all right. He's a real love."
"What are we doing back in this dark barn, Willie? Why are we not off to London? I showed you the jewels I got from Ma, Willie. I made her give me the cameo necklace, too. Now, please, can't we go to London to be wed? I do so want to wed with you, Willie."
"Mariah. Mariah.
You know what you are?"
"Oh."
"Clumsy, that's what you are. I bring you Daddy's pistol like you asked, and what do? It goes off in your hand. Now let's off to London, Willie. It's a bride I'm dying to be. Willie, are you there? I can hardly see you, Willie. Where are you?"
"Here I am. Lovey."
"Oh."
"Pink Lynch."
With the knife he sharpened last night. Then he carried Mariah down from the loft into the empty corn room. He left her there for a moment and ran down the road a piece.
Evening. Can I borrow the use of a spade? Taddeo.
And Billy Boy went back to the Red Barn and there he dug a hole. 6 by 3 by 3. I put Mariah in it and filled the hole again. And Billy took the high road to London. He also took the gun, the jewels, and the farthings. Not a care had he as he whistled his way down the road. Or Mariah's parents thought Mariah was with him. And in London...
Step ye up, lads. I'm just a country bumpkin trying to make my way in London town. So step you up. Here we have it. Here's a pea and here's three shells from walnuts. I placed a pea beneath the shell in the middle and moved the shells about. Now, who's a brave lad? Who's a clever lad? Tell me, under which shell is the pea? Not for free, lad. For a wager. A pound? A pound. Now, watch your clothes. This one on the end? We shall see. Well, you lose. It was under this one in the middle. Now, let's try it again.
And in 6 months, William Corder had enough money to purchase a house and a bakery shop, a feather bed upstairs, a parlor beneath it, and beneath the parlor, bread and buns. He needed only one more thing. So he went to the newspaper and he inserted an ad.
Lady for matrimony wanted. A private gentleman, aged 24, entirely independent, whose disposition is not to be exceeded, has lately lost his family to the hand of Providence. If this meets the eye of any agreeable lady who feels desirous of meeting with a sociable, tender, kind, and sympathizing companion, they will find this advertisement worthy of notice. Honor and secrecy may be relied on. Mr. X, 68, Leadenhall Street. Here, sir, insert this in the next edition.
Sir?
At your service?
There was an advertisement.
At your service?
Are you the
gentleman? Mr. X, I am he, if such as you are seeking him out.
The advertisement said sociable.
You were comely.
It said tender.
And your hair a shade of brown that will sweeten in the sunlight.
It said kind.
And hazel eyes.
It said a sympathizing companion.
How could such as fair as you need a sympathizing?
Gentlemen.
I kiss your hand.
Oh.
Inklin.
That's how they did it in 1827. At least that's the way William Corder did it. Quite a handyman, wasn't he? The way he got rid of one girl and found another. And in his neighborhood, when a pipe needed mending or a bun baked, "Aye, Willie Corder," the cry went up. "Aye, Willie Corder." Well, spring came, and one of the nicest sights on an April day on Leadenhall Street in London was the new Mrs. William Corder. She would lean her head against her husband, and arm in arm, they would stroll.
Willie.
It's the truth, every bit of it. When Wellington called for volunteers, I stepped out of their ranks.
Oh, Willie.
It's the truth, Bertie.
I know it's the truth, Willie. It's just that my heart is thumping because you might have been killed.
Me?
Oh, Willie.
But, Bertie, I knew when I volunteered nothing was going to happen. I hadn't met you yet, and I had to live to do that, so...
What else?
Huh?
What else happened to you before you met me?
Well, right before I met you, I was in Italy.
You said France. You said France, Willie.
Before France, I mean.
And the Italian women, what of them, Willie?
Oh, I didn't have no time to bother with them. I was on a secret mission.
Oh, Willie.
Now, don't you tell nobody.
Brave Willie.
You happy, Bertie?
Happy is as happy do.
Happy do, indeed.
Oh, yes. Willie?
Yes?
The jewels you're going to sell to my brother, how come you buy them?
By a gamble, a game of cards.
But they're a lady's jewels.
Then isn't it obvious, Duck? I gambled with a lady. In Genoa, it were, while on secret assignment. Garbed, I was like a gypsy.
I would have lost to you, too.
Downy bird.
Oh.
Come.
How, sister? Hi, Willie Corder. Hi, lad.
Nonny, Brother Sidney.
Twice and go to grass, brother-in-law, for what luck you had at the cards last night. And, will we cheat me at this transaction, too?
Isn't he priceless, Brother Sidney?
He's a good brother-in-law.
But how good? What price will you give me for these jewels to add to your stock?
Hmm. Middling goods.
You see, wife, your brother becomes a haggler when it comes to money.
Be generous, Sidney. What you give us will buy a new oven.
£50.
Done.
For this cameo necklace alone. This other stuff, not worth a shocked folly.
£50, then.
I'll write you out a check.
Daddy-o.
Good brother.
And of me.
A duck. A dilly duck. A love.
The very jewels Willie had stolen from the late Mariah Martin. And you remember where Mariah got them from. Her mother. And you remember her mother.
Mariah writes such nice letters, Huey.
Well, we can be proud. I never knew she could write.
I guess Willie Corder's taught her lots.
That's right. Mr. and Mrs. Martin were getting letters from Mariah since the very first week she was away. Once every fortnight. For a year now. Letters written on scented stationery in a feminine hand by Willie Corder. Chatty letters. Having to do with the shops in London.
Oh, I'd like stroll Piccadilly myself sometime. In ribbons like my daughter Dee does.
Newsy letters about trials and tribulations of her married life.
What you laughing?
Oh, come here and read this. Here.
I don't think that's very funny.
You wouldn't.
Warm letters.
Oh, isn't that a sweet thing she says here, Huey? I miss you, Ma, she says. I miss you, Pa, she says. And how's the farming, she asks. And how's the mole catching? And the field of my father's clay and rocks. Oh.
A good one. A likely daughter.
Only?
Only what?
Here she says, don't come to London, Ma, she says. Now, why would she say that?
Aggie.
What do you want?
Mariah could not write when she left here.
She writes good now. Better than me. Ah, oh, that Willie. Willie Corder, eh, lad?
Oh.
I frightened you, Will.
No. Oh, no.
What were you doing?
Writing.
Writing what?
Nothing.
Now. Don't try to hide anything from me, Will.
Oh, Pinklin, I wouldn't do that.
Then what writing were you doing?
Promise not to tell.
What writing, Will?
Promise.
I promise.
Come here. See this?
The check my brother gave you.
Look again.
For £150.
Uh-huh.
But he gave you a check for only 50.
Uh-huh.
Then what you were writing...
I fixed the check. Oh, what a joke on your brother. Hey.
Well.
Downy bird.
Forgery.
Not quite. Simply an extra £100. Clever.
Is it?
Clever.
It is.
Isn't it?
What a one.
Who?
What a... Now, who could that be?
The tradesman, I think. Let's go to the window and see. The tradesman. And see what he has for us.
A new bed warmer.
A new quilt. A new feather quilt.
And a pillow. A new pillow.
And look down there. A new bed.
Oh, what a one. What a one you are. Oh, husband. Tradesman, bring them in. Bring them all in. Everything.
And later on, they chuckled about what a wonderful joke he had played on his brother-in-law, Sidney. History does not record Sidney's reaction. It's true what Bertie said. What a one was William Corder. Especially what a one he was with the quill. Not only had he taken up hiking checks, but he was still penning those letters I told you about. Only the scent had been changed.
This latest letter I have here, Huey. Mariah says, should I ever be so bold as to come to London, she would not receive me.
She never could write.
Oh, go to sleep, old man.
And according to court reports and testimony, this is what happened then.
Go on. Go to sleep, old man.
Then, Mrs. Martin said, she fell asleep, too.
Mm-hmm.
Then?
Ma? Ma? Don't be frightened. frightened, Ma.
Maria?
It's me, Ma.
Maria?
Oh, Ma, it's terrible.
What? What's terrible?
What's happened to me?
What's happened to you? Don't you like London?
I'm not in London.
Not in London? Not in London?
Aye, Aggie. Aye.
London? Not in London?
Wake up, Aggie. Put the tea to a bubble.
Not in... Oh, I had me a fright, Hughie. A terrible, awful nightmare.
Poor the sheet you did. Now up to the tea lady.
Dreamt she wasn't in London.
Dreamt... Up to the tea lady. Oh.
Yes. Yes.
And the next night?
I never got to London, Ma.
Where did you get to, Maria?
Hardly away from here.
You dead, Maria?
I be dead, Ma.
Oh.
I be dead. I be not far from here, dead.
Where?
I be...
Wake, Aggie. Bubble the tea for me.
And on the third night...
In the red barn at the crossroads.
How come you're there?
He put knife to me and dug my grave.
In what place?
In the corn room, 3 feet down.
And Willie did that to you?
Willie did. You fix him, Ma. You fix him, you hear?
Huey! Wake up! Wake up, old man! Wake up! Murder's done!
What?
Our daughter, dear. She lies 3 feet under the corn room in the red barn.
Oh, God, you be down.
Mariah told me. In a dream, in a three-night dream, she told me, get shovel to you and dig! Up and get shovel to you!
He got up all right, and he got shovel to him, and together they went down to the red barn, and they dug, and they found a skeleton, and Mariah's shawl, and Mariah's shoes, and Mariah's dress. But the thing that clinched it, the thing that made them sure, the skeleton had the four front teeth missing in its lower jaw, exactly the four teeth that had been missing from Mariah's mouth when she was alive. And again and again as she ran down the road toward Polstead.
Police!
Which was finally heard by Constable James Lee, who viewed the body and rubbed his chin and took a trip to London, where he sought for and found William Corder, who was tried and found guilty. And a half hour before he was hanged, wrote a letter in his own hand on unscented paper, and, of course, signed in his own name.
Dear Birdie, good wife, I am fully aware of the shame and disgrace which I must have cost you. So that there be some vestige of pride remain, such as a woman should have for her husband, I suggest you bury me in the finest vestment obtainable, such as silk. My coffin, I do pray you for your own sake, should be of mahogany, with moulding of silver. A cherubim on my tombstone of marble, with some fitting sentiment such as, Willem Corder, of sweet and gentle memory, though not innocent of deed, I am innocent of heart. Goodbye, dear wife. Willem Corder.
On the scaffold there was some embarrassment because the trap would not work. Corder, who was, you'll remember, a very handy man, fixed it. But after the trap was sprung, it took him 12 minutes to die. So he probably didn't do a very good job. William Corder, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed by Bernard Herrmann and conducted by Wilbur Hatch. And the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Richard Peel was heard as William Corder, Betty Harford as Mariah, Alma Lawton as Birdie, Jeanette Nolan as the mother, Joseph Kearns as the father, and Donald Lawton as Sidney. Gil Warren speaking.
CBS, radio's gonna follow you, radio that's best. Praise that CBS, radio.
Send Uncle Sam a dime to win this war, and he'll pay you back with interest when he's won it. The easiest, most convenient way to lend him these dimes is to enroll in the payroll savings plan. Just tell your boss to deduct 10 cents from every dollar he pays you and lend it to Uncle Sam in your name. Sign up for this simple savings plan today, and when victory comes, you will have war bonds in your pockets instead of Axis bonds on your wrists.
I think one of the cool things about radio is that not everything came out of either New York or Los Angeles. There were outliers there. There were programs that were produced all over the country, some of them even from Oklahoma City. Next up is an episode of Dark Fantasy, a program produced in Oklahoma City by Scott Bishop, a man who would go on to make his mark in radio as a writer for such programs as The Mysterious Traveler and The Sealed Book. This episode is from March the 29th of 1942 and is called Rendezvous with Satan. It's all about a guy who wakes up dead one day. It must have been pretty important, I think, because, well, the climate is kind of warm, and Satan wants to have a word with him. Dark Fantasy.
Rendezvous with Satan. Good people, let us remember him who has passed, not for what he was, not for what he did, but because he was, as all of us are, a temple of God. Let us remember that this which is about to return to common clay was molded from common clay. Today we gather here to pay our last tribute to this now still flesh, lying here before us, clothed in the coldness of death. Let us always remember. And let us always remember.
The man again. Did you see him? He moved his hands. What are you saying? What are you saying? He moved his hand up toward his head.
Madam, please.
Oh, no. No, surely you're mistaken. I distinctly saw his hand move. He couldn't have. Carl. Carl. Oh, my darling.
Happened to me.
Just lie still, Carl Fisher. This craft is most fragile.
Where am I?
Where would you be after death?
Death? You say death?
Yes.
Am I dead?
They have your body in a church, Carl. Imagine you in a church.
No. No, you're mistaken. This is no church. I'm right here.
Apparently you are, yes. But we are most careful when we bring you here. We take every precaution to relieve the shock.
Shock?
Of finding yourself in the midst of fire and brimstone.
Hot. It's so hot.
You get used to it.
Where am I?
Your soul is here with me. Your body is back on Earth. At present, resting within a satin-lined coffin.
Coffin?
Yes. They're soon going to place you within a tomb.
Oh, I don't believe you.
Don't you? Personally, makes no difference to me whether you do or not. But for your own satisfaction, suppose you feel for yourself.
What?
Yes. Reach up with your right hand. Reach up. Feel the casket lining by your head. Go right ahead. There. You see?
Yes. But I'm lying in the bottom of a boat.
Only your soul is.
This is some trick. The boat is satin lined.
I'll admit, Carl Fisher, I am generally most concerned about my own comfort. But as far as lining one of my boats with satin, no. I fear that would be too much, even for Satan.
Satan?
Yes. Here, let me prove to you the boat is not cloth-lined. There. You see?
You devil.
That's irony.
You are a devil.
Yes, I am. But not just a devil. The devil.
You mean I'm really dead?
One never dies, Carl. The common clay perishes, yes. But only the common clay.
Let me out of here.
I'm sorry. You see, you can't move until I permit you to.
But I moved my hand a moment ago. Felt the lining near my head.
That's because I wished you to. Nothing is done here unless I order it done.
Then I am dead.
Only your body. It might interest you to know you caused quite a commotion up there a moment ago when you interrupted your funeral oration by suddenly moving in your casket. Yes, quite a commotion. Only two people saw you. One of them was a woman. You frightened her, Carl. But they've taken her away now.
You mean my body actually is being preached over?
Oh, yes. Indeed, yes. You were a prominent man on Earth, Carl. Naturally, yours a most elegant funeral. So many flowers, half of them could be brought into the church. People standing outside, on the sidewalk even.
Is Laura there?
Your wife? Oh, certainly. Where else would she be?
A church, you say?
Yes. Amazes you, doesn't it? You haven't been in a church for 35 years.
No.
You wouldn't even permit your daughter to be buried from a church, Carl. But she went to heaven. Anyway.
Stop it, stop it.
Do you remember Reverend Brooks, Carl?
Reverend Brooks?
Yes. He married you. Remember? Today, he's officiating at your funeral.
No. No.
Would you like to hear what he's saying, Carl? Listen.
If Carl Fisher has brought tragedy into our lives, let us remember that out of tragedy, good can arise. Soon that tragedy will be forgotten. But let us never forget Carl Fisher. Let us remember him always as a Christian.
You hear, Carl? A Christian, he says.
Stop. Stop that voice.
Listen, Carl.
Let us pray for him often and ask Almighty God to grant him pardon. Let us be generous towards him that finally the Supreme Ruler may in turn be generous towards us.
No. No, stop him. Stop him. I don't want to hear anymore.
Did you hear what he said, Carl? He asked your friends, your family, your wife, to forget your evil, to remember only what was good about you. Yes, Carl, but that leaves them nothing to remember.
Oh, let me alone.
No, Carl. They've nothing to remember. Because there was nothing about you that was good.
I didn't have a chance.
Chance? You say you didn't have a chance?
Certainly not.
Well, I'd only waste my breath by pointing out the chances you did have.
I was forced into everything that happened. Forced, I say.
Were you?
Certainly I was.
Haven't you ever heard of free will?
Free will? Free will, you say?
I haven't had a will of my own in the last 30 years.
Haven't you, Carl?
No. You know I haven't. I knew I was doing wrong. Sure, I knew it. I'd never have made my millions by being any other way.
Your millions. Did you enjoy them, Carl?
I was just beginning to when
I took charge of you. Is that it?
Yes.
Your millions aren't worth much here.
But where am I?
Certainly you haven't lost your imagination. Where would you be? With fire on all sides and the smell of brimstone. And with me as your pilot on the river Styx.
Styx?
You remember. It's our largest river.
Where are you taking me?
I have a special assignment for you, Mr. Fisher. We have a certain reserved space for members like you down here.
Inferno. Tell me. Am I in Hades?
Does that surprise you?
No. No, I can't be. I didn't want to die. I wanted to do what was right, but I couldn't.
You didn't try.
I was going to try.
You've done nothing but evil for 30 years. You couldn't change now.
I could, I tell you, I could.
No, Carl.
I'll make a bargain with you, Satan.
Bargain? No one makes bargains with Satan.
Give me a chance. Let me go back. Let me live my life over. I'll change. I swear I will.
You'd never change.
I will, I will. Let me go back. Let me show you. Let me prove I can do what's right.
All right, Carl. I'll bargain with you. It would at least relieve the dull monotony.
You give me a chance?
Yes, for 24 hours.
24 hours? Only 24 hours?
Yes. Do nothing but good for 24 hours, and I'll not return to claim you. But if you fail...
I won't fail. I won't, I won't.
It's up to you, Carl. It's entirely up to you. But remember, only 24 hours. Only 24 hours, Carl.
You really shouldn't have come tonight, Laura. You should rest.
I know. But I couldn't rest. Poor Carl. He needed someone so badly those last few days. And I was away. Never dreaming what was happening.
You mustn't blame yourself, Laura.
Oh, I can't help it. I feel I deserted my husband. Just when a man needs his wife most. There'll come a time, Dr. West, when I'll be afraid to come out here to the mausoleum. I wanted to come tonight to tell him goodbye.
Goodbye?
Yes. I loved my husband, David. Despite everything he did, he was the only one I ever cared for.
Here, my dear, I have the key. I say, Laura, it's not locked.
But I saw you lock it after the services this afternoon.
I did lock it. I'd swear I did.
Open the door.
Yes.
Do you have a light?
Yes. Pocket flash. There.
Oh, David.
Empty. The casket's empty.
David, for heaven's sakes, what's happened here?
I don't know, but Carl always said he'd come back.
What?
Yes. He told me once he had no fear of death, because he knew he could always make a deal with Satan.
Carl told you that?
Yes. I laughed at him at the time, but now I wonder. I'd better go now, Laura. Sure you're feeling all right?
Yes, I know I won't sleep tonight.
You can relax. I can send you out a nurse if you like.
Oh, no. No, I'd rather be alone.
Well, if you need me, please don't hesitate to call.
Thank you, David.
Good night, my dear.
Good night, David. And thank you so much for being such a dear.
I'll call you in the morning.
Good night.
That's strange. Yes. I'm not hearing things. That's an electric razor running. But it can't be. There's no one in the apartment but myself. Carl. 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 Carl.
Yes, my dear, did you call me?
Carl.
Yes, Laura, what is it?
Carl. Are you really there?
What do you mean, am I really here? Of course I'm here. Heavens, I was right in the middle of my shaving.
Oh, no.
Laura, what's the matter with you? Why'd you call me?
No, Carl, please don't come any closer, please.
The world's gotten into you all of a sudden.
Darling, is it really you?
Really me? Now, what are you talking about?
Carl, don't you know?
Don't I know what?
We buried you this afternoon. Carl, don't look at me like that.
Buried me?
Yes. Oh, darling, what's happened? Tell me, what's happened?
I don't know. Something's wrong.
Carl.
My head. Whirling. Dizzy. I don't remember what happened.
Oh, darling, you're alive. Mom, breathing.
Yes, but I seem to have been away. It was so hot. There was a boat on a river and a satin-lined casket and... Oh, Laura.
Darling, darling, you did come back. Dr. West said you would.
Dr. West?
Yes, David. He said you told him once you'd come back after... after you'd gone on.
Laura, I have been dead, haven't I?
Yes, Carl.
I remember now. I was sitting at my desk, sitting alone at night in my office, and then something happened.
You were shot. The back of the neck.
Everything stopped. The next thing I knew, I was riding in the bottom of a boat lined with silk. No, that wasn't the boat that was lined. It was the casket. He told me to move my hand and I'd feel it.
Who, Carl? Who told you?
It was the devil.
Carl.
Yeah. I died. Went to Hades. But I bargained with Satan. I bargained with him. He took me up, gave me 24 hours. 24 hours.
Darling. Darling, I don't understand.
24 hours to prove I could do good here on Earth.
Oh, is it true? Can it be real?
Yes, it is true. It's real.
I can't believe it. Things like this just don't happen.
This happened.
But Carl, how?
I made a bargain, I tell you. A bargain with Satan. And I have a rendezvous to keep with him in 24 hours.
I'm so confused, Carl. If only... Who could that be?
I'll go see.
Oh, no. It's anyone we know. They won't understand. You go back into the bedroom, dear. I'll see who it is.
But the world's got to know sometime.
Oh, people will know soon enough. Please, dear. I'm too upset for a scene to try to explain to anyone tonight.
All right, my dear, if you wish.
Thank you, darling. Just a moment. David.
I had to come back, Laura. I couldn't stay away.
David, please.
Forgive me, dearest. But I've waited so long.
David, please go.
No. Not until I've talked to you.
Some other time.
I can't wait any longer, Laura. It's not fair for you to ask me to.
Not fair?
You know I love you, Laura. You've known it for months, years.
David.
You have known, haven't you?
Yes, but...
I've waited so long to have the right to tell you about my love. Now, I know it's not right to come to you on the night of your husband's funeral and say these things, but I must know, Laura. I must know.
I have nothing to say to you, David, nothing.
I know you were always madly in love with that criminal of a husband of yours, but that's over now. You'll have to forget him. Oh, remember, darling, you're a young woman yet. Your life is still ahead of you. You can't go on carrying a torch for someone who cared more about making $1 million than making you happy.
David, don't say that.
I have a right to say it. Now, I've kept it in check all of these years, waiting and hoping. And now Carl is dead. You hear me? Dead. Dead. You belong to me now.
No, David. Not now or ever.
Yes. Yes, I say, you're mine. If anyone has a right to you, I have. After everything I've done to get you.
Will you go now, David?
Oh, Laura, Laura, I need you. Oh, Laura, please, sir, you'll marry me.
No, David. I'll never marry you.
But I know you care for me. I could make you learn to love me.
No, never. I've had nothing for you, David, but friendship. I'll never have more.
I know that's not true.
Don't say that.
It's not. You do care for me. I could tell by the way you kissed me. That's when I first began building my hopes.
Kissed you? When did I kiss you?
You haven't forgotten. The party in my penthouse. Not more than 3 months ago.
Your birthday party?
Yes.
All the girls kissed you that night. If you'll remember, we even made a sort of game out of it, lined up like a bunch of high school girls to compliment our host.
Yes, but you meant more than just a compliment that night.
You imagined it.
Oh, no.
I kissed you just like the others, in full sight of my husband. And I might add, to his complete amusement.
Carl wasn't in the room. You waited until he'd left before you got into line.
Oh, nonsense, David.
No. I knew that night you cared for me. That's when I began planning to make you mine.
David, will you please go?
Not until you've told me you'll marry me.
I've told you I won't.
There's someone else.
Only my husband.
Someone else. Someone who's alive.
Please go, David.
What's that?
I want you to go.
What was that? In that other room?
Nothing.
What are you...
Nothing at all.
What are you doing?
I don't want you to ever come back here, David.
What are you doing?
I'm locking this door. I'm in no mood to have you go ransacking my place.
There's someone in that room.
David.
So, you couldn't wait until your husband was safely buried. Couldn't wait.
David.
Well, he won't have you. You hear me? He won't have you.
David. Please go now.
Very well. But I'm telling you this, Laura. He won't have you. Whoever he is, he'll never have you. I promise you that.
Carl? You heard?
Yes.
Well?
Wait, Carl. She's been having an affair behind your back, hasn't she? She deserves to be killed, doesn't she? Well, go ahead and kill her.
I don't have to tell you, Carl. I've never cared for him.
Go ahead, Carl. Kill her. She's lying, don't you think?
No one but you, darling. Ever.
I can still tempt you, Carl. That's my job. That's how I keep my fires burning.
I know you believe me, Carl.
No. Don't believe her. She's never lied to you before, but there's always a first time.
Darling, please don't stand there looking at me. Say something.
She wants you to say something. Well, go ahead. Say something.
Darling.
It's all right, dearest. I believe you. People will say when I walk out into the world again.
Carl, don't you think it would be best for us to go away quietly? Someplace where we'd never be recognized?
No, Laura. I have a bargain to fulfill. Only until 3 this afternoon.
You'll spend that time with me then?
I'm sorry, I can't.
There's more to be done than probably either of us imagined.
Where are you going?
To the office first.
I'll go with you.
No, dear. I'll come back to you before I leave you again. To keep my rendezvous with Satan. Good morning, Miss Walling.
Good morning, Mr. Fisher. You're early this morning, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Fisher.
Confounded girl. How she'll make a scene. I'll spend all morning explaining. Nothing doing. I'll lock myself in the office. West.
Come in, Carl. I've been waiting for you.
Sitting in my chair. At my desk.
Yes. This is your gun, I believe.
What's the meaning of this?
I'm prepared to make a bargain with you.
Bargain?
Yes.
What sort of a bargain?
You died without leaving a will. I have one here dated 3 months before your death. Sign it, the business becomes mine. And I'll permit you to take away half of your $7 million and Laura.
You permit me?
Yes. You couldn't operate your business now. People wouldn't want to do business with a dead man.
Do I look dead to you?
Don't be facetious. I'm serious. I know all about what happened to you. When I came back to see Laura last night, I heard you talking before I pushed the buzzer. I don't understand it all, but I'm prepared to give Laura up for your business and half your cash.
You killed me.
What?
You killed me.
Fisher, keep back.
I see it clearly now. I see now that Laura wasn't lying to me last night. She's never cared for you.
I warn you, keep back, Fisher.
I remember what you said to her. You said, if anyone has a right to you, Laura, I have. After everything I've done to get you.
This gun is loaded, Carl.
Yes, I see it all clearly now.
Stay back. Stay away from me.
The night she kissed you at the party. Remember what you said about that last night? That was the night you began planning to make her yours.
If you come any nearer, I'll shoot.
I'm not going to harm you, Dr. West.
You'd like to get your hands on this gun. You'd like to kill me, wouldn't you?
Kill you? No, I can't kill you. I've made a bargain not to.
Then keep back.
I could kill you, though. I've been proclaimed legally dead, you know. You can't hang a dead man.
Keep back. One step farther and I'll shoot.
I told you I don't intend to harm
you. Stop where you are.
I just want you to take a good look at me, Doctor.
Stop. Not one step farther. Not one step farther.
Laura.
Oh, darling, are you hurt?
It's nothing.
He shot you, Carl.
Laura. That gun in your hand.
I followed you here. I don't know why I brought the gun.
Laura. You killed him.
Oh, darling.
Give it to me.
No.
Give it to me. Give it to me.
Carl, you must get to a doctor.
No. Look at the clock. No time for a doctor.
You're hurt badly.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Give me that gun.
Carl.
Give it to me. There. Now they'll think we shot each other.
Carl! 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 Oh, my darling. My darling!
You have won your bargain, Carl Fisher. There's no place here for you now.
You have heard Rendezvous with Satan, tonight's original tale of dark fantasy by Scott Bishop, originating in the studios of WKY.
Ben Morris was Carl Fisher. Blois Wright played Dr. David West. Eleanor Naylor Corrin was Laura Fisher. Fred Wayne took the part of Satan. Muir Height was heard as Reverend Brooks. And Georgiana Cook Height played the secretary. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. Now here in segment 3 is an episode of Theater 5, which was the American Broadcasting Company's attempt to revive radio during the 1960s. This series derived its name from its time slot. It was run at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. It was an anthology series of short stories. Each would run about 20 minutes with local programming, you know, commercials, news, to fill out the last 10 minutes. There was a good bit of science fiction, and some of the plots seemed like they were taken from the daily newspapers. The program ran between August the 3rd of 1964 and July 30th of 1965. Today's episode is a bit of science fiction called Incident at Apogee. It was the 20th episode of Theater 5 and aired on August the 28th of 1964.
Even you space geniuses don't know everything.
Just a pinprick, that's all. Just a pinhole in your shiny spacesuit and you'd explode like a kid balloon.
Even you space geniuses don't have a test for everything.
You're gonna be a satellite, boy. A little star out there in infinity. All alone.
You gotta listen to me, hon. You're wrong about last night. Any night.
Theater 5 presents Incident at Apogee.
So help me, Charlie, it's the truth. If I hadn't gone that extra orbit, she'd never have married me.
Oh, I don't believe a word of it, Charlie. I was all his before he ever crawled into a cat's
mouth. Oh, that's news to me.
Well, a girl has to have some secrets.
I must have been pretty hairy in the old days.
Old days? That 101 orbit flash referred to occurred less than 3 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to imply...
And let's drop that sir stuff, shall we? When we get up there tomorrow, it'll be just the two of us, Charlie and Pappy, okay?
Okay. Pappy?
How about another cup of coffee, Charlie?
Well, I don't know. Should I, Pappy?
Oh, can't hurt you. You won't sleep tonight anyway. None of them do the night before their first flight.
Scared, Charlie?
Why should I be scared when I got the best man in the space business to pilot me?
I bow as low as these creaking old bones will permit.
And who could be scared after such a wonderful dinner?
Oh, I'll just curtsy.
It was awfully kind of you to have me.
Oh, at least we could do. Man ought to have a good dinner his last night on Earth.
Pappy, you make it sound so final.
Oh, could be, with what he's got ahead of him.
First man to leave a capsule in base.
Oh, I wonder what it will be like floating all alone up there.
I'll tell you when I get back.
Promise?
Promise.
Honey, what you need is a wife to worry about you. And to worry about. How come still a bachelor?
No, I don't know. I've been busy with other things. I never gave marriage much thought.
Well, it's time you did. There's nothing out there in space quite like a good woman back on Earth. Is there, Pappy?
Not that I know of. Uh-oh. The blowtorch, I'll... Colonel Sedgwick speaking.
This is Control, Colonel. T-minus 730. Time to suit up.
Thank you. We're on our way.
Time.
Time.
Well, here we go again.
No, here we go.
Like to change places? Just once?
You ought to be used to this by now, sweetie. I am.
My part, you never get used to.
Maybe I better get out of the car.
You take care of yourself, handsome. And come back in one piece. The women of America need you. There aren't enough like you to go around.
Yeah. Well, thanks for dinner.
Hey, wait for Pappy.
Honey, aren't you going to...
You know something, Sue?
What?
That little farewell speech you just made to the kid.
What about it?
It's the same speech you made to me the night before my first flight. Word for word.
Bye, baby.
It's now T-minus 223. Launch will be at 0400. Posegrade rockets will put you into orbit at T-plus 5 minutes and 30 seconds. You'll then be at your closest point to Earth on this ride, at an altitude of 480 miles.
What will our apogee be, our farthest point from Earth?
On the order of 30,000 miles.
That's on the outer fringe of the Earth's magnetic field.
No problem. Earth's gravity will keep you in orbit.
Just barely.
Do I take an order from the project officer to leave the capsule and execute the free flight maneuver?
No, I won't give the order. That'll be at the discretion of Colonel Sedgwick as command astronaut.
This is the part that always gets me. What's that, Pappy?
Waiting. Sweating it out, stuffed into this miserable capsule while they're getting her ready to go.
Well, you sure don't show it.
Capsule from control. Capsule Pegasus from control.
Pegasus 4, Colonel Sedgwick.
We're ready to connect you with Mrs. Sedgwick, sir.
Thank you, but that won't be necessary this time.
But, sir...
I said goodbye to Mrs. Sedgwick last night.
Now, let me have that phone. Pegasus 4, project officer here.
Yeah, Harry?
Control read you negative on last transmission.
Affirmative. Negative is correct. I didn't want to take the call.
Is everything all right, Pappy?
Sure.
There's still time to scrub the flight.
There's nothing wrong. Nothing at all, Harry. Now let's get on with it. I got the jitters up here.
Roger. You're now T-minus 15 seconds. Good luck.
Thanks, Harry.
14, 13, 12.
As I used to say, kid, this is it.
10,
seatbelt 9, fastened. No smoking 8, sign on.
7,
as they also
6,
used to say,
5,
A-OK.
3, 2, 1, 0.
Liftoff.
Roger. I have a liftoff, and the clock is operating.
Roger, loud and clear.
Pegasus 4 is underway. Pegasus 4 to Earth Command. Pegasus 4 to Earthcom.
Reading you loud and clear, Pegasus.
Pegasus 4 reporting in orbit.
That's how it shows here, Pappy. May we have your orbit checklist at this time?
Roger. Retro attitude command.
Off.
Retro rocket fire.
Off.
Antenna fairing release.
On.
Pilot abort.
Off. And let's keep it that way.
We'll try, kid. We'll try. That's it, Earthcom. Orbit checklist completed. Now going on auto control.
Roger. How is it?
No quiver at all on yaw, pitch, or roll. Holding very nicely.
Pretty good equipment, isn't it?
The best.
Well, have a nice ride.
Why not?
Let us know if you need anything.
Wouldn't think of doing business with anyone else.
Roger.
A nice bunch down there, kid. I say we have a grand group on the ground, Charlie.
Huh?
What's the matter with you?
The view. Would you look at that view?
Yeah, it's quite a sight. First time out. How do you feel?
Great. Just great. The view, it's too much. Hey, look down there underneath. It's that island.
Bermuda.
Already?
Great place for a honeymoon, Bermuda.
I'll bet.
Yeah. That's where I took Sue after we were married. After I'd broken 100 orbits. When I was the glamour boy of the space program. When I was where you are now.
What are you talking about? I never went 100 orbits. I haven't even gone one yet.
Yeah, but you're tomorrow's hero. Because you'll be the first man ever to leave a spacecraft and float outside in emptiness. Fellow was right when he said space was young man's business. And already it's splitting into specialties.
Well, I can't help that. I just do as I'm told.
Yeah, you just keep that up, kid. No room for individual initiative in space. Up here, teamwork counts. You can be the big man when you get back to Earth.
Well, what are you driving at, Pappy?
What do you think of my wife, Charlie?
Sue?
Yeah, that's what her friends call her.
Well, I hope I'm considered a friend.
Oh, I'm sure you are. You didn't answer my question.
Well, I don't know her very well.
Don't you?
But I think she's a marvelous person. And I know she's a marvelous cook.
Yeah, she seems to think a lot of you, too.
Well, how could she? We only...
She could.
Look here, Pappy. What are you insinuating?
Nothing. Forget it. I'm sorry. I get like this sometimes on a tough mission. You know, depressed.
The great Pappy Sedgwick, depressed?
Ever hear the phrase, the captain hates the sea?
Yeah.
Well, that's me, doubled in space.
I don't believe it.
That's been a well-kept secret.
until now.
It still is.
And it better be.
But look, Pappy, if it's bad, I mean, there's no point in going through the exercise. We could...
abort the mission?
Yes, if you...
You'd be the loser. The world would think you chickened out. They'd never guess an old space pro like me had lost his touch or his nerve.
Well, I'll take my chances on that rather than see you go through with it. If
Don't
you have
worry,
any...
I'll fly the mission. I'll get you there. You'll have your big moment.
But, Pappy, I really think
On
that...
this mission, I think. You take orders. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
This is Earthcom. This is Earthcom. Come in, Pegasus 4.
This is Pegasus 4. And proceeding according to flight plan. Apogee will be reached in 12 minutes. We'll conduct free flight experiment at that time.
On the first pass?
It's at my discretion, Earthcom. You said so yourself.
So I did. So I did. Good luck, Pappy. You too, Charlie.
Thanks.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes.
There's a lady who wants to talk to you.
I can't see anybody during the mission.
Well, that's what I told her, but she won't go away.
I'm afraid that's your fault.
No, sir, it's yours. She says she's the wife of the colonel you got about.
Mrs. Sedgwick?
Yes, sir.
Oh, why didn't you say so? Send her in. Send her in.
Yes, sir. Would you please come in?
I'm sorry to bother you, Harry. I know how busy you must be.
Not that busy, Sue. As a matter of fact, we've just closed down transmission.
Oh?
Now, the boys are getting ready for the free flight exercise.
Already?
That's the way Pappy wants it. And I guess he's right. We had a textbook launch. Everything go.
I know. I watched it on TV. Everything go, but Pappy.
What's that mean?
Harry, I'm worried about him.
Why?
Just before liftoff, when I phoned, you told me he was too busy to talk. You weren't telling me the truth, were you, Harry?
Well...
The truth is, he wouldn't take the call. Isn't that right?
Well, now...
Isn't it, Harry?
Yes, that's right, Sue. He refused to take the call. He said he'd already said goodbye to you last night.
Last night? He walked out and slammed the door in my face.
What?
Charlie was over for dinner. And Pappy got some kind of a wild idea that I'd go for the kid.
He ought to have his head examined.
Yes, Harry. I think he should.
Sue.
I'm serious. Even you space geniuses don't have a test for everything. Maybe paranoia goes along with weightlessness. Or schizophrenia hides in the cramped couch of a capsule. I don't know. Do you? When I couldn't get through to him during the countdown, I was sure there was something seriously wrong.
This is very alarming, Sue, but I don't know what we can do about it at this late date.
I do.
What?
Let me talk to him.
He ordered transmission cut off.
Order it back on. You're the boss, aren't you?
On the ground. He's head man in the spacecraft.
Pegasus 4 to Earth Command.
Roger, Pegasus.
Let me talk to him.
Pegasus 4, position report. Coming up to Apogee at an altitude of 30,550 miles. At this altitude, the Earth has taken on a bluish cast. And the sun and all the stars are untwinkling holes in the black firmament. And, well, that is to say, all systems are still go. We are prepared to proceed with free flight exercise. Co-pilot is rigged with auxiliary rocket pack. Umbilical tether is connected, and we're standing by to open hatch. Are you reading me, Earthcom?
Four square, Pegasus. This is the project officer.
Yeah, Harry?
Your wife's here, Pappy. She wants to talk to you.
Say again, Earthcom.
Your wife. Sue's here. She wants to talk to you. Stand by. I'll put her on the pipe.
I'm not reading you, Earthcom.
Pappy, listen. This is Sue.
You're not getting through, Earthcom.
Listen to me, hon. You've got to listen. You're wrong about last night. Any night.
You're coming through faint and garbled, Earthcom. You're unreadable.
Pappy, you've got to believe me.
Cut the channel, Charlie.
But she's trying to tell you something.
That's an order, mister.
Yes, sir.
Pappy.
It might have been important.
Come on, let's get on with it. Suit pressure.
Building. Coming up to 12 pounds square inch. Mark.
Roger. Cabin pressure.
Dropping. 3, 2, 1. Mark. Cabin pressure 0 per square inch.
Roger.
Transferring oxygen from cabin tanks to portable pack.
You only got 20 minutes supply.
I know. I don't expect to be out there half that long. Anyway, in case anything goes wrong, you'll pull me in by the umbilical tether.
Sure, kid. Hatch open. Well, there it is, kid. Space. And it's all yours.
Roger.
Zero gravity. Zero pressure. Vacuum. Makes you feel kind of funny, doesn't it?
I feel okay.
I mean, so close to infinity. Just a pinprick, that's all. Just a pinhole in your shiny spacesuit and you'd explode like a kid's balloon. Just a little pinhole. Makes you think.
Yeah. Well, I better get over the side.
Roger. Out you go. All right, now give a good push.
Well, that isn't what they taught us at Houston.
You just listen to old Pappy and shove real good. You want to get everything out of this exercise, don't you? Experience independent flight, like you were a satellite yourself, then shove.
Roger. But you hang on to that umbilical.
Sure, kid, don't you worry.
So long.
Pegasus 4 to Earth, Com. I am ready with status report from Apogee.
Pappy, honey, you've got to listen to me.
Earthcom, this is Pegasus. Getting crosstalk on this frequency. Can you clear at your end?
Pappy, for heaven's sake, that's your wife.
I still do not read you loud and clear. Do you want a status report at this time?
Roger, Pegasus 4. Proceed with your report.
Cabin pressure, zero. Suit pressure, 14 pounds per square inch. Co-pilot has gone over the side with 20-minute oxygen supply.
Co-pilot, now in free outside capsule. Floating in space. 50 feet from capsule. At extreme reach of umbilical tether. Umbilical tether now disconnected. Co-pilot is now floating free, all by himself.
Oh, my God.
Happy, what are you doing?
He deliberately cut him loose from the capsule.
Happy...
I can't back.
That's right, Charlie, my boy. You can't walk back, you can't swim back, and you can't fly back. You're just never coming back.
Oh, no.
You're going to be a satellite, boy. A little star. And maybe someday the astronomers will give you a name like Lady Killer or Carlos Minor, the Wife Stealer. Something appropriate like that. Something that'll tell the world why you're there. Because you're going to be there for a long time, boy. Meat keeps real good in a vacuum, you know.
Charlie, can you hear me? Say if you can hear me.
Roger, Earthcom. I read you.
Your auxiliary rockets on your backpack. Use it.
Sure. I forgot. Firing auxiliary rockets.
Oh, no, you don't. You can't catch me. I got more thrust than you have, kid.
Happy, don't.
Firing maximum thrust.
You'll blast yourself out of orbit.
You'll never catch me now, Charlie Lady Killer. Ha, ha.
What is it, Harry? What's he done?
Hear those rocket engines?
Yes.
Nearly 1,000,000 pounds of thrust.
Oh.
They're ripping Pegasus 4 loose from Earth's gravity.
Earthcom! Earthcom!
Roger, Charlie.
He's gone. Just like that. All I can see is an afterburner. Like a little comet long gone. And now it's gone out. And there are only the stars.
What's happening, Harry? Tell me.
Happy's put himself into another orbit. Around the sun. Forever. Charlie.
I read you, Earthcom.
Are you comfortable?
Yeah, sure. I feel fine.
You know there's nothing we can do for you, Charlie.
I know.
You have less than 15 minutes of oxygen left.
I know, but...
Yes, Charlie?
The view.
see this view.
Presented Incident at Apogee, written by William Ed Robeson and directed by Ted Bell. In the cast, Ralph Camargo, George Petrie, Joan Shea, Cliff Carpenter, Richard Hurd, and Jack Manning. Audio engineer Bill Sandreuter. Sound technician Ed Blaney. Script editor Jack C. Wilson. Original music by Alexander Vlastatsenko. Orchestra under the direction of Glenn Osser. Executive producer for Theater 5, Edward A. Byron. This is Fred Foy speaking.
The Conclave of Corpses, Anonymous. Some 300 years since, when the convent of Kreuzberg was in its glory, one of the monks who dwelt therein, wishing to ascertain something of the hereafter of those whose bodies lay all undecayed in the cemetery, visited it alone in the dead of night, for the purpose of prosecuting his inquiries on that fearful subject. As he opened the trap-door of the vault, a light burst from below. But, deeming it to be only the lamp of the sacristan, the monk drew back and awaited his departure, concealed behind the high altar. The sacristan emerged not, however, from the opening, and the monk, tired of waiting, approached and finally descended the rugged steps which led into the dreary depths. No sooner had he set foot on the lowermost stair, then the well-known scene underwent a complete transformation in his eyes. He had long been accustomed to visit the vault, and whenever the sacristan went thither, he was almost sure to be with him. He therefore knew every part of it, as well as he did the interior of his own narrow cell, and the arrangement of its contents was perfectly familiar to his eyes. What, then, was his horror to perceive that this arrangement, which even but that morning had come under his observation as usual, was altogether altered, and a new and wonderful one substituted in its stead. A dim, lurid light pervaded the desolate abode of darkness, and it just sufficed to give to his view a sight of the most singular description. On each side of him the dead but imperishable bodies of the long-buried brothers of the convent sat erect in their lidless coffins, their cold, starry eyes glaring at him with lifeless rigidity, their withered fingers locked together on their breasts, their stiffened limbs motionless and still. It was a sight to petrify the stoutest heart, and the monks quailed before it, though he was a philosopher and a skeptic to boot. At the upper end of the vault, at a rude table formed of a decayed coffin, or something which once served the same purpose, sat three monks. They were the oldest corpses in the charnel house, for the inquisitive brother knew their faces well, and the cadaverous hue of their cheeks seemed still more cadaverous in the dim light shed upon them, while their hollow eyes gave forth what looked to him like flashes of flame. A large book lay open before one of them, and the others bent over the rotten table as if in intense pain or in deep and fixed attention. No word was said, no sound was heard. The vault was as silent as the grave, its awful tenants still as statues. Fain would the curious monk have receded from this horrible place. Fain would he have retraced his steps and sought again his cell. Fain would he have shut his eyes to the fearful scene, but he could not stir from the spot. He felt rooted there, and, though he once succeeded in turning his eyes to the entrance of the vault, to his infinite surprise and dismay, he could not discover where it lay, nor perceive any possible means of exit. He stood thus for some time. At length, the aged monk at the table beckoned him to advance. With slow, tottering steps, he made his way to the group, and at length stood in front of the table while the other monks raised their heads and glanced at him with a fixed, lifeless look that froze the current of his blood. He knew not what to do, His senses were fast forsaking him. Heaven seemed to have deserted him for his incredulity. In this moment of doubt and fear, he bethought him of a prayer, and, as he proceeded, he felt himself becoming possessed of a confidence he had before unknown. He looked on the book before him. It was a large volume bound in black and clasped with bands of gold, with fastenings of the same metal. It was inscribed at the top of each page, Liber Obedienti. He could read no further. He then looked first in the eyes of him before whom it lay open, and then in those of his fellows. He finally glanced around the vault of the corpses who filled every visible coffin in its dark and spacious womb. Speech came to him, and resolution to use it. He addressed himself to the awful beings in whose presence he stood, in the words of one having authority with him. Pax vobis, 'twas thus he spake, peace be to ye. Hic nulla pax, replied an ancient monk in a hollow, tremulous tone, baring his breast the while. Here is no peace. He pointed to his bosom as he spoke, and the monk, casting his eye upon it, beheld his heart within, surrounded by living fire, which seemed to feed on it, but not consume it. He turned away in affright, but ceased not to prosecute his inquiries. Pax vobis, in nomine Domini, he spake again. Peace be to ye, in the name of the Lord. Hic non pax. The hollow and heart-rending tone of the ancient monk who sat at the right of the table were heard to answer. On glancing at the bared bosom of this hapless being, also the same sight was exhibited. The heart, surrounded by a devouring flame, but still remaining fresh and unconsumed under its operation. Once more the monk turned away and addressed the aged man in the center. Pax vobis, in nomine Domini, he proceeded. At these words, the being to whom they were addressed raised his head, put forward his hand, and, closing the book with a loud clap, said, Speak on. It is yours to ask, and mine to answer. The monk felt reassured, and his courage rose with the occasion. Who are ye? He inquired. Who may ye be? We know not, was the answer. Alas, we know not. We know not, we know not, echoed in melancholy tones the denizens of the vault. What do ye here? Pursued the querist. We await the last day, the day of the last judgment. Alas for us, woe, 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 resounded on all sides. The monk was appalled, but still he proceeded. What did ye to deserve such doom as this? What may your crime be that deserves such dole and sorrow? As he asked the question, the earth shook under him, and a crowd of skeletons uprose from a range of graves which yawned suddenly at his feet. These are our victims, answered the old monk. They suffered at our hands. We suffer now, while they are at peace, and we shall suffer. For how long? Asked the monk. Forever and ever, was the answer. Forever and ever, forever and ever, died along the vault. May God have mercy on us, was all the monk could exclaim. The skeletons vanished, the graves closing over them. The aged men disappeared from his view. The bodies fell back in their coffins. The light fled, and the den of death was once more enveloped in its usual darkness. On the monk's revival, he found himself lying at the foot of the altar. The gray dawn of a spring morning was visible, and he was fain to retire to his cell as secretly as he could, for fear he should be discovered. From thenceforth he eschewed vain philosophy, says the legend, and, devoting his time to the pursuit of true knowledge and the extension of the power, greatness, and glory of the Church, died in the odor of sanctity, and was buried in that holy vault where his body is still visible. Requiescat in pace. End of the Conclave of Corpses. This is a LibriVox recording.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock. 9, 13, 14, 17, or, just a minute. Or to hell with it.
Coming up next is the series
Murder at Midnight.
I'm sorry, I know I shouldn't do that. It's melodramatic, it's silly, it's even a little cheap. I could claim that it was somehow impulsive that I have a soundboard here that I just push a button and it inserts
Murder at Midnight
into the recording. Truth is, I don't have a soundboard, but talking about it just now, I think, wow, I really ought to get one of those things. They do exist. There are free ones on the net. I should really get myself a soundboard, but I digress. Yeah, I know, I do a lot of digressing. See, I even digress in my digressions. Let me try to get back to this. Not having a soundboard, I actually have to go into the file and cut and paste.
Murder at Midnight.
I don't know. It's just, I like this show pretty well. But I love
Murder at Midnight.
It seems to typify everything an old-time radio show should be. As does this show. It wasn't a really long-running show. It began on the Mutual Network on September the 16th of 1946 to run until September the 8th of 1947. It sometimes used script borrowed from the Inner Sanctum and featured tales of the supernatural and macabre, written by some of the top writers and performed by some of the top stars of the time. If it wasn't macabre, I probably wouldn't be running it on the show, would I? It's a bunch of tales of death at midnight, the witching hour when night is darkest, our fears are strongest, our strength at its lowest ebb, midnight, when the graves open up and death strikes. Tonight's Murder at Midnight is the second show of that short-lived series and is from September the 23rd of 1946.
Yes, this is the place for it. Deep down under the city, under the earth. The concrete cold and damp as the stone of a mausoleum. The question is, which one of them shall it be? You, sir? You with the gray hair and the briefcase. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Death.
Midnight, the witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a minute in The Man Who Was Death. Midnight, Tales of Mystery and Terror by Masters of the Macabre. Our story by Robert Newman is The Man Who Was Death. It's late afternoon in the studio of Jan Rolf, the sculptor. The rays of the setting sun come through the smoke-filmed glass of his skylight at an angle, casting long, dark shadows on the dusty floor. His face intense, Rolf stands before a more than life-size head of gray granite, cutting away some of the hard stone, then pausing to examine his work.
It's still not right. I still haven't got it. And I don't know where I've gone wrong. The eyes, they would be brooding and half-closed. But shouldn't they be all-seeing? Let's try it. Who's that? Who's there?
It's Aline, Mr. Rolf. Aline Moffat.
Aline? Oh, yes. Just a second. What is it, Aline?
I told you I wouldn't be able to get here until late, Mr. Rolf, that I was going to be modeling for Clayton in the early afternoon, but you said it didn't matter.
Oh, yes, I forgot.
If you don't need me, don't feel like working.
No, it's all right. Maybe it would help if I worked on something else for a change. Come on in.
Something else? Oh, that head.
Is that the first time you've seen it?
Yes. You always kept it covered up before. It looks very powerful.
Powerful, eh? Go on over to it, closer. Tell me who you think it is.
All right. It's a man. Pretty big man.
Man. I knew it wasn't right. But if that's all you get out of it... Where's that mallet?
Mr. Rock, what are you going to do?
Yes, I'm going to smash it. Almost 6 months' work, but... There! You know what that was supposed to be? Death! Yes. For centuries, man has been haunted and obsessed by the fear of death. I'm going to do something no artist has ever done before. Show mankind the face of death.
Mr. Rolf, I don't think I feel like modeling this afternoon.
You're frightened. Why?
I don't know. The whole idea of...
You too. What I wanted to show was the beauty, the peace that lies in death. Death's strength and inevitability and... Wait a minute.
I'll phone you tomorrow, Mr. Rolf.
I said wait. It's beginning to come to me. What was wrong? To do a study, portray something, you've got to understand it. Inside and out. You've got to know how your subject thinks, feels, project yourself into it. To do a study of death, I've got to know all those things about him. I've got to become death. And that means...
Mr. Rolf, no. No, you can't.
But I can, Aline. I must. How can I understand death, become death, if I don't kill?
Miss Craig?
Yes, Nancy Craig.
I'm Jordan, Harold Jordan of Homicide. I imagine you know why I asked you to come down here to the morgue.
Well, they said it had something to do with my roommate, Aline Moffat. Is she...
If you think you can take it, we'd like you to make the identification.
I think I can.
Ah, good girl. She's right here under the sheet. Ready?
Yes. Oh, Aline. How did it happen?
Yeah, I'll cover her up. Well, we traced the laundry mark. We're pretty sure we knew who she was.
How did it happen?
She was found in the river. But she was dead before she went in, strangled.
Murdered? Oh, but why? By whom?
We don't know. We thought you might help us with that, too. Tell us what you know about her.
There's not much to tell. She was a wonderful girl. Came from out of town, out west somewhere. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know it from the way she looks now, but she was beautiful. She used to do modeling.
Any boyfriends?
Oh, no one in particular. She went out with a lot of different men. Everyone liked her. It's why I can't understand.
Who does she model for?
A few photographers, but mostly painters and sculptors. Let me see. There was Jensen, Clayton, Rolf. As a matter of fact, I think she was posing for both Clayton and Ron.
Better this time, much better. Things I can put into it that I never knew. Never felt before. Now, let's see. No! Still not right. Still something missing in... not just a shade of expression, but something basic. One of the keys to the whole concept. But what? Haven't I played Death's role, killed just as he does? Haven't I... Wait, that's it. Of course. Is that how death strikes? Without thought, on the spur of the moment? No. He picks and chooses. Decides just who shall die and who shall not. What's missing is the consciousness of power. The knowledge that there is no appeal from death. That he is the supreme authority. And that means that... yes. I must kill again. And this time... Who's that?
Police department. Can we come in and talk to you for a minute?
Why, yes, of course. Just a second. Police. They don't know anything. They can't know. But I better cover this up.
Mr. Ross?
Yes.
I'm Jordan of Homicide. This is Nancy Craig. Sorry to bother you at this time of night.
No bother at all. Please come in.
Thank you.
I'm investigating the murder of Miss Craig's roommate, Aline Moffat.
Murder?
You didn't know?
Why, no. I never read the papers. The last time I saw her, 2 or 3 days ago.
Well, it happened just 2 days ago. Now, we've been checking back. We have an idea that you may have been one of the last people to see her alive.
If there's anything I can do to help, anything at all...
Could you tell us what happened when you did see her last?
Of course. She was due here at 3 o'clock, but actually came at about 5.
Mm-hmm.
She said another artist had delayed her.
Clayton, that's right.
I had already started working on something else, and since she looked so tired, I suggested we call the whole thing off. She seemed pretty happy about it. Left, and I'm afraid that's all I know.
Was there anyone else here? Anyone that actually saw her leave?
I'm afraid not. You see, I'm the only tenant in the building who lives here, and I'm afraid everyone else had gone by then.
Well, that sounds pretty straight to me. I guess that's that. Thanks very much, Mr. Rolfe.
Not at all. Afraid I haven't been much help. But if you can think of anything I can do...
We'll keep in touch with you. And in the meantime, well, maybe you should start reading the papers just every once in a while, huh?
Right. I hope you read them too, my friend. Especially tomorrow's papers. Because I have a feeling that there just might be something in them that will interest you. Night. And a fine small rain. Yes, this is how he would move. Walking slowly through the darkness. Searching. Weighing. Selecting his victim.
I beg your pardon,
what?
Sir. But could you tell me if that's the uptown subway over there?
Why, yes. I believe it is.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Not at all. Subway. What better place to make my choice than there? Deep under the earth. The concrete cold and damp as the stone of a mausoleum. Thank you, my friend. Thank you. Yes, this is it. This is the place. The tunnel dark as a yawning grave. The platform edge like the verge of infinity. And this is how he must feel. Studying. Selecting. Which one of you shall it be? You, madam, with the worn coat and the draggled hat. Why are you looking at me like that? Do you know what's in my mind? Don't be afraid. It won't be you. You, young man, with the books and the glasses? No. Then what about... Yes. Down there at the end of the platform, my friend who suggested this. My prosperous-looking friend with the gray hair and the briefcase. Don't look up at the track so impatiently. A train is coming. But so am I. Good evening.
I beg your pardon, sir, but I'm afraid... Oh, I didn't recognize you at first. Why, you're the chap.
I directed you down here, yes. But I felt that you should know exactly who it was you spoke to. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Death.
What? What do you mean? What are you doing to me? Let go! Let go!
Quietly, the man who is Death steps back from the edge of the platform as the train grinds to a stop. A woman screams. And somewhere in the distance, a clock strikes 12 for...
Murder! At midnight.
Now back to the story of The Man Who Was Death. It's late the next afternoon, and Jordan is alone in his bare cubbyhole in police headquarters when there is a knock on the door.
Come.
Hello, Mr. Jordan.
Oh, hello, Nancy.
You don't seem very happy to see me.
I am, and I'm not. It's a nice change to have someone as pretty as you come down here. On the other hand...
You haven't gotten anywhere with Aline's murder.
Nah, no motive, no clue, no nothing. I'm afraid we're licked.
But you can't be. You can't give up.
I'm sorry, Nancy. I don't like it either, but, well, it happens sometimes.
But you can't let it happen. Not in this case.
You're pretty well wound up, aren't you? How about letting me take you out, buy you dinner?
No. I am upset, yes, but...
What's the matter?
Oh, maybe it's nerves. That trip down to the morgue, the whole atmosphere around the case, but would you think I was mad if I told you I felt that some horrible power was abroad? That Death himself was stalking through the city?
You and Mrs. Dolan.
Mrs. Dolan? Who's she?
Well, that accident in the subway last night, a guy who fell or jumped in front of a train. Didn't you read about it?
No.
Well, this Mrs. Dolan was one of the witnesses, and... She swears that just before it happened, she went all goose pimples, felt as if Death was breathing down the back of her neck, and that she was going to die.
It's true, Hal. I know it is. I mean, well, that's exactly how I felt. I can't remember just where or when, but sometime during these past few days, I felt that I was in the same room with Death myself.
Well, like you said, it's probably nerves, strain you've been under. Just the same, it's kind of a funny coincidence. I think maybe I'll go see Mrs. Dolan, talk to her. Do you want to come?
I don't believe so, Hal. Somehow I feel we're awfully close to the answer. If I could just remember where and when it was I felt that way, that I was in Death's presence. I think I'll go home.
Okay, Nancy. I'll call you there after I talk to Mrs. Dolan, and, well, maybe we'll find that we really had something.
Just a little more off the cheekbones. Get the gaunt feeling of a skull under the flesh. No, it's still not right. Still something missing. But what is it this time? Didn't I stalk and select my victim? Didn't he recognize me for what I was? Death himself. And didn't... Wait. Of course. It's never just the victim alone who knows, fears, and fights against death. It's all of society, medicine, science, the police. All of man's resources from time immemorial lined up against death. And he still triumphs over them. That is the secret and the measure of his omnipotence. That is the last missing element. And that means that I must kill yet again. And this time, Not just the victim, but the whole world must know it and be powerless to stop me. This time... Who's that? Who's there?
Nancy Craig, Mr. Rolfe. I don't know if you remember me.
Nancy? Oh, yes, just a second.
I'm awfully sorry to be bothering you again, but...
That's perfectly all right. Isn't Mr. Jordan with you?
No, I came alone. Well, there was a little experiment I wanted to try.
Oh, please come in.
Thank you.
Just what was this experiment?
It was probably pretty silly, but I had to try it. Thinking back, I had a queer feeling that I... What's that?
A bust. Something I'm working on. Something I hope will be my masterpiece. Do you like it?
I'm afraid I... No. Oh, it's awful. It's terrible. It was here that I felt it. Here in the studio, and you...
Yes, Nancy. It was I who killed a lean Muppet, and also a gray-haired gentleman with a briefcase in the subway last night.
That piece in the paper, Mrs. Dolan...
Exactly. You see, that bust over there is a study of death. And to do a study, you must project yourself inside your subject. That meant I had to become death. Where are you going?
Out of here, you're mad!
No good, Nancy, no good! I locked the door when you came in.
Oh, but you can't! But you can't! Help! Help me! Help! Help!
No good either. We're 5 stories up, and all the other tenants have gone. You came here at a very opportune time for me. I had just decided I needed one final victim, and I'm afraid that's going to be you.
I'll never forget it, Mr. Jordan. It was pretty late, about 12 o'clock, and it was raining. There were only a couple of people on the subway platform, 3 or 4, and I was standing by myself, not thinking about anything in particular, when suddenly this feeling came over me.
What kind of a feeling?
Oh, a feeling that this was the end. A feeling that death was standing there, right close behind me. I got so weak and shaky that I thought I was going to faint. I shut my eyes and leaned against one of the posts, and that's how it was that I didn't actually see the accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you turn around when you had that funny feeling? Did you notice whether there actually was anyone standing behind you?
I did. There was just a young fellow with glasses and another man. Kind of strange looking, now that I think of it.
Strange? How?
He was about 35 or 40, pretty big. I guess it was his hair. He wasn't wearing any hat, and Billy was almost white and very long and bushy.
What? Did he have a thin face, gaunt and deep-set eyes?
Why, yes, I think he did have. Do you know him?
I'm not sure. If I do, then I may know a lot of other things, too. Good Lord. Nancy.
What?
I've got to get out of here.
Just a second, young fellow. Where do you think you're going?
In there. No one's going to... Hanrahan.
Oh, there you are, Jordan. Where the blazes have you been?
What do you mean? What's going on?
A devil of a business. A lunatic in the top floor studio there. He phoned headquarters, asked for you. Said that he had a girl there that he was going to murder. Said that he wanted us to know, even though there was nothing we could do to stop him. We thought it was a gag at first.
Well, what are you doing about it?
Everything that can be done. I've got men all around the building. Up in the roof, across the street, outside his door.
Can't you break down the door?
Sure, and finish her off quick. He said that if we tried it, he'd bash her brains out with that big hammer that he's working with.
But there must be something, a Tommy gun from the roof across the street.
He's got her right in front of him, so that if you got him, you'd get her too. I tell you, there's nothing, absolutely nothing anyone can do.
You're wrong, Hanrahan. There's just one person, one thing that can stop him.
What's that?
Death.
You're getting impatient, my dear.
Oh, why are you doing this? You know you can't get away with it.
Get away with it? You think I care that it matters to me whether I live or die when I finish this? I'll never be able to surpass this, but neither will anyone else. I know now how death must feel. I've caught it forever. For all men to see in stone.
Yes, friend Rob. You have. And you've made me very proud.
What? Who's that?
You don't know. Even though I've been on your mind for months now. Even though you're just finishing my portrait.
You? Where are you?
Where would I be? Everywhere. Outside in the hall. Down in the street. Here in the studio with you.
Can you be seen? I must see you. I must.
Very well. Walk this way. Over towards the door. A little further. A little further.
All right, here I am, Ralph. Maybe I don't look the way you thought I would.
Jordan!
Yes. Now drop that mallet and get your hands up.
It was you, and I thought...
Get him up, Ralph, I said. Okay, if that's the way you want it...
Help!
It's okay, baby. It's all over now. Oh. Have you loose in a minute.
Jordan, are you all right?
Yes, break the door down if you want to come in. I'm busy.
Oh, you got him. But how?
I talked to him through the vent pipe from up on the roof. I figured that if he was crazy enough to do all the things he did do, he might be crazy enough to believe death could pay him a visit. When I'd maneuvered him far enough away from Nancy here, I jumped through the skylight.
Hal! Hal, look!
Good Lord.
What is it?
That bust he was working on. He said it was a study of death. And in a way, I guess it is. Because it's a self-portrait.
Two men and a girl, staring down at the body of the dead sculptor, lying next to his weird masterpiece. But is it possible that there is still someone else in the studio? An unseen presence that has been there since the clock first struck 12 for...
Murder at midnight. Remember to be with us again when death walks through the darkened streets while the clocks strike 12 for Murder at Midnight.
The part of Jan Rolfe was played by Frank Behrens. With music by Charles Paul, Murder at Midnight was directed by Anton M. Leder.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention that the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the internet. And there's a good deal of ancillary material there, more details about the shows, and even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. Anyway, take care of yourself. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.